Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon. My name is David Sincox, and I'm delighted to be here with you. And on behalf of Management Forum Steering Committee, I am very pleased to see such a great turnout. It's wonderful. And to this Managers Matters with the principal, Heather Munro-Bloom. Joining her to help us navigate the questions and themes that you have sent in, we have Vice Principal Michael DeGrappa, and in the audience we have AVP Lynn Gervais as well. So we will have some support in the types of activities that we're going to go through today. One note about, this is more of a housekeeping note, this room holds 125. We have over 144 in the room now. We have Bruce on this side. He's going to help us to see where the actual fire exits are in case there is a disruption or any security things. So by special request, Bruce is just like any air traffic or airline stewardess, you would stand up and give us the directions, you know, out through the side door. So just note if there's any incident, follow Bruce or follow Rosemary out those doors there. She'll be the first out, no doubt. So Management Forum and the Steering Committee is really honored to invite our 16th Principal and Vice Chancellor, Heather Munro-Bloom, and I'd just like to invite her here to do a short welcome.
Thank you very much, David, and thank you all for inviting me to come, and Michael, and for having this opportunity. It's a really important time. I'm hoping there are no Alex Baldwins in the audience for our folks who are guarding the security entrances and exits. This has been an unusual fall, to put it mildly, and I thought I would just begin by expressing my heartfelt thanks to each and every one of you. I know you've, many of you, if not a majority of you, shouldered an extra burden through this fall. It has been, as Dickens would say, the best and worst of times, because it's been a challenge at the heart of our community in terms of us having dear colleagues out on the picket lines. And at the same time, it has been both a moment when the dedicated people within the university did their utmost to keep the university operating on its academic mission, to have our teaching and scholarly and research programs going to the best of their ability. And it wasn't business as usual, as we've said several times, but it was a Herculean task carried very much by you and others, and with the patience and support of the whole community. And so I want to say again very clearly to you, I know, as I say to those of you who work in my own building, you're often the silent heroes behind the success of the university. And so this was a time when that was in great evidence. But as well, you know, sort of ironically, this fall was a time that McGill had the most positive public impact locally, nationally, and internationally that it's had in some 50 years. The work of the last period on the shoulders of all of you and members across our community, including our colleagues who are out on the picket lines, and our students, and that of our volunteer members of our community, is really paying off in terms of McGill succeeding, notwithstanding underfunding, notwithstanding the ups and downs of life both within the institution and in the broader context, the vicissitudes of the economy, all of that. McGill is prevailing and contributing at a quality and with a reputation and a culture that matches with the very best universities in the world. And that's something we can all be proud of. Sometimes I feel like my mother, who would always be a step ahead of me and saying, yeah, I know you've done that, but, you know, here's something else, that we do have to just stop and celebrate and smell the roses. And so knowing that the holidays are around the corner allows us an opportunity to do that, but today is a moment to do it collectively as this very important group of the university membership. So thanks for that. I will, I guess, get to say a few closing words at the end. But I did want to say that we do have the principal skating party. I don't know how many decades it's gone on, but it's this Sunday, and it'll be a very important time for you to come out with your family and friends to really be part of us reengaging as a community in a positive way and going into the holidays feeling good about ourselves and our place and each other. And I want to make special reference without revealing any secrets that Eyal will be there in his normal role of bringing the holiday spirit to the skating event. So, you guess what he does. What I do hope today is that we can have an exchange on wide-ranging issues. It's very, very helpful to me to hear what's at top of mind for you, not just coming off the fall, but thinking to the year ahead. And what can we be doing collaboratively and collectively and with Vice Principal DeGrappa and Madame Gervais and our group across the university to make this the place that you feel is the best fit for you, that allows you to use your talents fully, that supports you in the best way possible to do what you're here to do. So there's nothing, I think, that's taboo. I'll tell you if there is, if it comes up. But I really see this as a time for us to really have a good exchange. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Principal. That's great opening remarks. So, as your moderator, I said I was delighted to be here earlier. I'm delighted to be your moderator. I'm very excited about this. And if I get nervous and you can't understand what I'm saying because I'm going too soft or too loud, please, at the back, just let me know and I'll slow down and I'll try to bring in what you need to hear. So, the first thing is, this is going to be an interactive session. When we looked at all the questions in the comments, there are over 100 of them that you folks wrote in. And it became very clear that it was important that we condense the information because we only have a short time. It's an hour and a half. So to help us follow up with this session, we have John at the back who's videotaping. This will be posted online on the M-Forum website afterwards. In addition, we'll have whatever questions we can't get to today or topics that we start, we have a parking lot over here. And Lauren Penny, who's part of the M-Forum Steering Committee, she'll be gathering the ideas as we move from one topic to another. So if there are follow-up items, rest assured the Management Forum Steering Committee, the principal and her team, were committed to seeing this through to help get some answers and build on this place that we work in called McGill. Also, a note about Managers Matters. For the provost, that video, there were some issues with the video and getting it up online. It's expected shortly. And as soon as we get it, we'll put it up there. So, to get us started, my job is to sort of help steer this discussion. You've sent in your questions. We are going to flip this around a little bit so you do a little bit more talking than you expected. And basically, I will summarize the comments and questions that came in, and I will direct the principal, I will direct comments to the principal if necessary, and then turn to you to offer solutions to some of the questions that are asked. As mentioned in your email yesterday from, that's Antonia, by the way, she's our chair. As mentioned in the email from Tony yesterday, we will have three themes: compensating and rewarding performance, building skills in current employees for career advancement and succession, and then rebuilding the community. With community in mind, I thought a good way to start this would be to do an icebreaker. Now, you may say, well, what's an icebreaker? Some of you in the audience know what it is. It's a way to connect. So I want you to turn to someone that you know or you don't know, and introduce yourself if you don't know them. Tell them how long you've been working here and why you work at McGill. You have 3 minutes. Do that now, please. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Wow. More? Let it go?
Ladies and gentlemen, can I have your attention again? Ladies and gentlemen, wow. You want to talk about building community? Bravo. That was amazing. I asked for a call to order three times.
Did you hear me the first time?
Nope.
Second? Just the third. Wonderful activity. So now that you know who you are, who wants to tell me why they work at McGill? Anyone? Why do you work at McGill? What did you hear? Thank you, A.L.
Why do I work at McGill? This place is special. It's just a nice place to work for because the people that you meet every day and the clients that you meet, they respect McGill. McGill has a nice name around the country, around the world, and I hear it all the time, so that's why I work for McGill.
Thank you, A.L. Judy, dear. Oh, yes, that's my first reminder. You have to press the little red button.
It certainly isn't because of the summer fridays or the floating. It's definitely because of the community. It's the community at large that matters to, I think, most of us managers here. And the fact that we get to work in an academic setting and help students, it's so enriching and rewarding. That's why we're here at McGill.
Thank you, Judy. One more?
I graduated from McGill a year and a half ago, and I left for a while, and I came back as soon as I could because I wanted to be as involved as possible in the student experience here, and I enjoyed it so much as a student that I wanted to make a commitment to being a part of what I saw and what I loved.
Thank you. So this is the essence of our discussion today, to reconnect here, why we're here. And the first topic, the first theme is going to be about compensating and rewarding your performance for the hard work that you do, for your commitment, for wanting to be part of this large institution that has really positive things to offer many of our students and families that work here. That's our first one, and we'll bridge that with building skills and career advancement. Our topic is succession planning. This is a huge topic. It's complicated. There are many aspects to it. So when we tried to squish it down, it was tough. We'll do our best to cover some of these things. And as I mentioned at the beginning, the format will really be up to you to provide input on what we have received from the community. So let's do a trial run and see how I go through the first section. So I'm going to summarize the comments. Then the principal will have the opportunity to address you in a question format or with a comment. Okay? First question. And there are four of them. What is the university doing regarding succession planning and promoting from within? That's a really hot topic. And this topic is followed by, or that question was followed by a comment, while recruiting external candidates has its own well-valued pros, promotion from within, if carefully planned for in some cases, far outweighs the advantages of external recruitment. A good initiative is the Leadership Development Program. Where's Linda? Wonderful. Such a program, though, needs to be supported by well-crafted succession plans at department or unit level. And these succession plans have to be be visible to employees. Next question. We have seen a number of senior administrative positions go to external candidates.
in the recent past. Is there a mandate from senior administration to human resources to develop McGill's non-academic staff for positions of leadership and senior posts? And if so, can you state explicitly what that mandate is and how you see it being manifest currently? Two other points. What is the university doing to retrain and promote young managers under the age of 35? HR seems to block any ability for our managers to redefine M-job categories and promote from within. For example, the policy that we are restricted to 6% increases only, but that new hires, external hires, are able to negotiate from scratch within the broad job category. Last comment, misleading postings. Notice how huge this is? This is just a huge thing. Misleading postings. Postings that are, I'll call this transparency. There are many term employees hired at the M level whose positions eventually are posted as permanent positions, available listings on the employee site, but they result in being false, misleading postings. For example, the position was intended for the term employee all along, and the current M staff who applied only applied to find out that the application process was a waste of their time. The position was going to the term employee, that's why they were hired. What can, will the principal do to curb this practice as it prevents growth and development opportunities for current full-time M staff? So now I turn this one to you.
Well, terrific questions. Thank you all for raising them. And I'll comment at the level of the succession piece of this, because I think the other questions kind of feed into that. What are the incentives to see this as a place where you might have a career? What are the incentives for developing your abilities to be able to compete successfully? And I think maybe behind the questions in a way is, how do I even get on the radar screen at the institutional level or beyond my own program level so that people will be thinking about me as they're looking at development. So let me say a few words about this. First of all, it's a huge preoccupation for me and for the senior team. And one of the paradoxes, maybe you can help me understand it better, and this is my ninth fall, January will be my 9-year anniversary as principal at McGill, is how we have such a successful place and such an engaged community with, I must say, this is the sixth university I've been at it as an adult, all of them large research-intensive universities. This is the only one I've been at where people actually care about the place. In fact, I would say a hallmark of the other five was that everybody kind of cared about themselves and not about the institution. And we have symbols and realities of the engagement with the institution as a whole. And yet, if I think back to 2002 when I was appointed and 2003 when I began, there were a lot of elements of the professionalization of the management aspects of McGill, and I would say maybe the Quebec University system, that were out of step with what I experienced elsewhere in North America, where I'd been. And that may be, you know, because of the budget cuts in the middle of the 90s. It may have been because of, you know, other challenges that we always had this high, high value placed on academic quality and excellence, but kind of failed to take into account systemically what a large operation this is, how much management's required to run the place well, how much success is a part of services and supports, all of that. And so, you know, one of the aims over the last years has been to try and build some of that modern progressive culture in. And you folks no doubt have been in each of your own areas trying to push for that as well, and certainly many of you succeeding, but how do we lift that so it becomes systemic across the university, from how do you do project management on a new initiative to not just say you're going to do it but get the support to do it and have it done to other things. And succession planning is a fundamental part of good management, and so is renewal. And renewal can happen from within, as the questions pointed out, and renewal can happen from outside. I have kind of as a magic metric that if we, on average, in any one group of employees over time have the leadership coming roughly half from within and half from without, it's a great indicator of McGill's strength because it means we're competitive in attracting people in from outside who have choices about where they go, and it means we're competitive for our colleagues in supporting you and helping you in your development, and seeing you as really, you know, our talent's all we've got. McGill is our people, as a number of you said when you talked about why you wanted to be here. So I would say we're in about year three. I'm looking at Lynn because we've been working on this together. We're in about year three of really formally thinking about succession in the administrative ranks and trying to build that into the academic administrative ranks as well. In the last decade, all of our deans have been newly appointed, all of them on the basis of an international search, and of them, roughly half have come from within in that international competition and half have been recruited from outside. We have, in the last year, Lynn and I presented to the Board of Governors for all of the leadership positions when you look at the top level across the university, and there are a lot because we have a very distributed leadership, looked at, you know, what's a professional succession plan there from within? And that immediately starts to put a spotlight on where haven't we been thinking about that? Where haven't we been cultivating that? And so I think we're at a point, and we're not defensive about this, that a number of initiatives have been launched. The thinking is there. Some processes are getting underway. But we have a long way to go in having this so that, for example, for you as an employee group of McGill, all of that is transparent and clear, and you get a chance to both voice what you're interested in and what your own plans are. And I know some people will say, I don't see this as a career. I see it as a job. I like what I'm doing, but I want to be the best I can in the job I'm in. That's one set of goals that you have for yourself, and that's important. Not everybody wants to be moving around. But it should be somewhere as well that whether you're older or you're younger, if you want to still develop your career in the sense of moving to different positions, we should know it. We should be interacting with you in a way that gives realistic feedback on what's required to get there, and that talks about whether or not that's a likelihood in the next 2, 3, 5 years, given what we know about the mobility of the workforce and the development of the workforce within. So we are committed to this. It is a high priority. It's moving, but it's, I would say, in kind of, you know, not a baby, but it's in early stages of development. And I think I can speak for Michael and Lynn when I say we want to hear from you as well about what the methodologies and services and information are that would make that supportive to your own goals. And it may be for some of you as well, this is something I hear on the academic leadership side, that you're at the other end of your career and you're actually wondering who's going to replace you and how you're going to get an opportunity to mentor, and how do we use mentoring in effect across the board to help with management, development skills, and the like. So that's at a pretty high level, but I want to say it's not by way of avoidance. It's actually to say it is a priority. It's new within our kind of annual goals of what it is we're hoping to see. Michael and Lynn have responsibility for kind of developing the plans and bringing them forward. But I think we want this to be very interactive and shaped by you. So I want to just give Michael and Lynn both a chance to respond as well.
No, just to say that in our own area, working with Lynn, we're identifying or putting in place a succession plan for the direct reports to the vice principal, and asking each of them then to prepare similar plans. And we're doing this as a kind of a pilot project to see how this goes. The idea being trying to identify what the gaps may be in the skills that are necessary for each of the positions, and then trying to develop appropriate training plans, development plans for individuals. I think the goal is to give those who wanted a career path at McGill so that they can look to see themselves here for the long-term future. Lynn?
I'd like to bring it up just a notch and think about our succession when we're very focused on succession planning because of the demographics. We're not privileged here at McGill to be outside of the demographic bubble of post-Second World War, and we're all going to face, and if we're not facing it already, really big changes in the workforce. 60% of the jobs that we have today are only being filled by 20% of the competencies that we need. So we really have a huge, huge gap to fill in terms of the future generations, in terms of employees that come to McGill, and you yourselves who are here at McGill, and in terms of how quickly can we upskill you to meet the demands of the future. But I'd like to look at it more as a talent management program as opposed to a just per se succession planning program. As Michael and the principal has mentioned, we are working on pilots in succession planning. Importantly, the senior administrators of the university as a first step, and then now down to the levels of the VP and those that report into the VPs. But we're also doing pilots in four different areas. I mentioned DARA and University Services. We're working out the program there to see we don't want a horse if we need a camel, or the opposite, the camel if we need a horse. So we're trying to find a program in succession planning that will be easy to administer and not just stay on the shelf, because a lot of companies have succession plans where they just stay on the shelf. Everybody goes through the motions, they go through the big exercise, and then we never look at it. We really want to focus on it as a talent management program. So what did we do about it? Well, the principal launched her strategic reframing initiative. One of the major SRIs, as we call them, is talent management. We're trying, and we had a bit of a three-month put it on the back burner period, unfortunately. But the talent management program and SRI will look at performance dialogue, and I can talk about that for a while if you want, on training, on competency development, on career aspirations, on your succession planning. So it's an all-encompassing process around you as McGill employees and in terms of your aspirations and the needs of the organization, the institution, in terms of meeting their objectives. And it's tied. Right now, if those of you who have been involved, and I think the provost was here not long ago giving his, the school is the word I have in French, but his address to you on the white paper that's now moved to being called an ASAP. And it, in there, there are objectives specifically to performance management, development, and career aspirations of our employee groups. So it's tied.
Thanks, Lynn. David, I wonder if we could just take three or four inputs on things that colleagues would like us to be considering against this backdrop.
Okay. So from what the principal has asked, are there any comments related to succession planning, the plans that Lynn has mentioned, and the types of activities that are going on in the principal's planning processes? Something from you, something that we can address or that she can address over the next coming year, years.
I noticed that there was mentioned that a good portion of the managers were lacking competencies for the levels that they were in. Were there any specific competencies that really stood out? And if they do stand out, does HR have plans to boost up training in that area? I think one of the problems is when we're looking at succession planning or managing talent is it's a very vague thing for most people. And to start thinking about it, we sort of need a guideline of what you're looking for and what we're missing. And even before you get to the units, if they start thinking about those things and they can look at what they've got in their office and be a little more prepared so that when these do roll out, you're already halfway there because they've been doing some critical thinking in the units.
I'm sure Lynn will have more examples, but one that comes to mind, just by the nature of the way we handle problems as they come up, is project management. And I think that we have to build up the capacity for people to work in sometimes virtual organizations to deal with a specific project for a set period of time using certain templates and formats so that they could be replicated as you go from project to project. So that's just one that comes to off the top of my head. Lynn, I don't know if there are other kinds of competencies.
Two things, Rosemary, on competencies. We have two types of competencies. We have a focus on skills, concrete, technical competencies that are very specific, project management as the example that Michael gave. But there's also, as managers, as all of you in this room, that we need to focus on that are transferable competencies that are of huge value to the institution, and they're called behavioral competencies. So Human Resources, a couple of years ago, developed 7 behavioral competencies. In an ideal world, we would like to have only 5, but there are 2 in those 7 competencies that are a evolution or a transition for us to be able to get to where we think our managers should be to be able to have their career and also meet the objectives of the institution. Those 7 competencies, as an example of behavioral competency, and one that is very important, and I bet you loved it a lot lately, is managerial courage. So what do we do? Well, first of all, we've integrated those 7 competencies in the LDP program. So the Leadership Development Program, for those of you who have gone through that program, we have a huge focus on how do we develop those 7 competencies for our leaders. The other thing is we've incorporated into our performance dialogue. So when you're having the conversation with your supervisors, you should focus, and I've said it, and we've piloted in HR, and I said to my direct report, pick one. You can't do 7, pick one. Pick one that you want to focus on this year, and we will tailor your training accordingly to that competency that you want to move to. So there are, and they're posted, the 7 competencies on behavioral are, and then there's the technical ones. Do I need to have Excel super duper 2 or 3, or do I need to have more labor relations experience, and we have training for that, and more tailored technical competencies, but the focus for managers is on the behavioral competencies because they're transferable.
Thank you. Can I ask how many people have participated in some leadership development program? Just a show of hands.
We have 200 new graduates.
200 new graduates. That's great. And can I see the hands that haven't yet had a chance? Okay. Postponed. Yeah, right. We had a little postponement. Yeah, so lots of opportunity there. I would just add to the question, and it's an excellent one, Rosemary. It's really hard to do things if you don't know what they are. And I would say project management, and I would say that's as much a skill we have to develop on the academic side as it is on the administrative side. And the other one, which is also uniform, and I think it comes about because we're in a very bilingual, multilingual context, is writing ability. Communication. We seem to, it's a bit paradoxical that we're a university and we seem to have a hard time saying things clearly, getting things out in time, and communicating in a way that is not equivocal, that is certain, clear, says what's expected and also what's being offered when it's an offer. So these are things that we're all working on.
So at this juncture, I have one over here. Sorry, I didn't see it.
It's okay. Sorry, I'll be quick. But I wanted just to say that I appreciated hearing the Provo invite managers to participate in working groups on career development. And I think that sort of engagement is important, and that's something I appreciate. My question related to succession planning, renewal planning, talent management in the bigger picture, and at what stage are HR policies or even HR cultural norms kind of evaluated as we're making these new plans for talent management? The policies are not the afterthought or reflection. They're supporting talent management. So particularly it related with that example of if I, want to be promoted and I have these policies that support rather someone from outside over myself, or any number of things, at what stage are HR policies evaluated and even the culture in this system?
Why don't I take that as a directive and suggestion in the sense that we actually had an example this morning of an innovative new program being presented to the senior team in the strategic reframing initiative context, where the talent actually wasn't considered at all, wasn't developed in the proposal. And I felt terrific that within our own group, my team, everybody's saying, well, that can't go forward, you know, without us really understanding who are the people, who's going to do it, how should that happen. So I think your point's really germane. We should be looking at our policies and not assuming that what's been there for 20 or 30 years is going to serve today. And I think HR is doing a good job of that. But sometimes something will come out of the research arena or the educational program arena or something, and you don't think about it as HR. That would be an example this morning where we were looking at a research initiative. And we need to keep the people element of this in line. Let me just finish this point by saying I know of nowhere where we have an automatic predisposition to go outside rather than inside. They're on academic appointments, because we benchmark against our peers and how we recruit and retain professors. In that domain, we do all searches internationally, but that's not with a predisposition that the person will come from outside. It's to say we're open to the best person there. And I think as well, just on the talent management theme, that we need to be as proud when someone who's been developed at McGill goes somewhere else. And we lost a dean recently who'd just been reappointed, our dean of engineering, who'd done a spectacular job, who went to be provost of one of the great research university systems in the U.S. And everybody's like, oh, it's awful, you know, it's awful. So I don't know, I think it's pretty good that we're a feeder for that as well.
Yes, hello everybody. My name is Kelly and I'm from the McGill Executive Institute. And some people have said that we're one of McGill's best-kept secrets, and I'd like to reveal that secret today, that we are here as an institute in the Faculty of Management, and we actually do have a lab on project management, among other hard and soft skills, leadership training, and it's all available.
Can I speak to you at the end of this morning?
Absolutely. So I just wanted to say now and then we do see one or two people from McGill participating in our programs. We would love to see more and welcome you to the Institute at any time. www.executive.mcgill.ca.
Very nice plug, and that's on the bottom of the homepage as well in one of the features. So I have Rosemary.
I've taken a lot of courses with the Executive Institute, and they actually are very good because you have people from outside, which makes you think differently about how McGill does things. And that we are unique, but we can take things from industry and apply them in a university environment. And the outside also learns more about what the university is doing. The courses, I understand, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe if you're a McGill employee, it is half the cost of what the outside pays. So the impact to your budget is not what you see on the web page.
That is correct. And we've eliminated all other discounts except the McGill one.
Well, Kathleen and then Greg.
Very briefly speaking to that, I actually attended the IA International Master's Program in Practicing Management from the Executive Institute, and it was excellent. And, you know, they did have all sorts of excellent ideas when you visit other countries as part of that program. So in India, in succession planning, for example, because of the demographic issues, they actually have mentoring programs where you have your senior administrators select at least three people from their team as part of their talent management, one of which is a woman. So that you develop all three, and then when it comes time for that person to leave, then they select one of the three. So even if the one woman isn't so developed, at least she has had the exposure to the senior administration to be on their radar. In Korea, they have all these community buildings with their senior administration, their directors, their CEO brings out the young junior managers, and they go on these social activities, just them, in order to get to know them better and to build that sense of community as well. So it's great.
The whole notion of mentoring is something that these are all great examples, and it's great to know about the program. But I think just the concept of mentoring is a really important one that we could do a lot more to develop again across the university.
So I have Greg Blatchford, and then I think we're going to move on because there's another topic that's coming in line with succession planning.
Thank you, David, and thank you to the principal and for coming today to speak with us. I've been here about 17 years now, and so I'm kind of a mid-range person. Some people have been much longer, some people much shorter. And I, especially as a director in student services, have found the talent planning initiatives to be very positive. Performance dialogue helps very much. The succession planning, the renewal. So that's something I found very, very helpful. But I want to take a bit of a twist to this that I'd really, we've heard more and more recently, and it kind of scares me a bit, is Bill 100 from the Quebec government, which, and I want to know, I don't know how much is factual about this or not, but I think this could get in the way of some of the initiatives that you're putting in, trying to put in place with such efforts. Which will force, I believe, universities, and you can correct me if I've got this wrong, to reduce expenditures and restrict salary increases to specifically administrative and support employee groups, reduce the headcount as well, as I understand it. And I don't know, because these external, will these external factors impinge and get in the way of the progress you're trying to make towards a greater professionalization and modernization of the workforce?
It's a great question, Greg, and I welcome a chance to clarify and certainly invite Michael and Lynn to jump in if there's a more nuanced element to this. The bill does require two things. One, it requires that anyone who's getting a bonus not get a bonus anymore if they're in the upper echelons. McGill's rare in having almost no one who gets a bonus in the upper echelon, but there are certain jobs in the university that are revenue generating where people are on contracts and have targets, and so we've been trying to figure out how to work around that because it's built into their compensation system. But that piece affects us less than the Quebec University system, which has a very strong bonusing element to their comp system, as the public service does in Quebec. But the other one is a very real objective that we must meet, which is that for every person who, it's not just retiring, it's every person who leaves the university, isn't it, Lynn? It's just retires? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so it's technically of those only one of two positions where retirements take place gets retained to the university. But that doesn't prevent us at all from reconfiguring. And part of the beauty of the first set of questions is really that we can be reorganizing positions to make them contemporary and progressive in real time, in ways that are using and developing your skills better to the contemporary needs of the institution and moving kind of past the old jobs that are the two for one deal. That means us being very proactive in thinking about the major domains of work in each of the employee groups, and what are the competencies that are needed, what are the skill sets that are needed, how do we help people rise into those and develop those. But it is a challenge, and there is without question, Quebec has a cost-cutting and a headcount reduction goal in their measures.
Is that for the universities just, or is it public service?
No, it's the public service. I mean, you might, if you had to guess, and you look at the budgetary and economic problems facing Quebec, you might say it's even more targeted to the public service, to the government bureaucracy than it is to us. Quebec has a larger government bureaucracy than Canada as a nation or the U.S. as a nation, just as an example. So that's a big ticket item.
Thank you. Okay. Very lively discussion on that topic, and that we really did get the most comments and feedback in that section, and there is an opportunity for this dialogue to continue. We'll continue to bring sessions like this to talk about succession planning, and as Lynn and her team and Michael and your team, as this launches and rolls out into McGill, you'll see more of it, and we'll bring information to you as soon as it's ready to come. The next question is related to succession planning, and it's more of, this is a maybe the behind-the-scenes type question that only anonymous writers can send in. So it's a little bit, it's equity and training opportunities. We had three questions come in that focus on equity and training. So can you do something to make sure that all managers have the opportunity to participate in training and that their supervisors do not block them under the guise that they cannot be spared? You're all valuable, but you can't go to training. Question two, why McGill as a higher education institute does not offer better opportunities to its staff for continuing their education into a graduate degree, master's or PhD level compared to other companies? For example, a good number of companies who value education cover the education expense, perhaps at the McGill Institute, while McGill covers only the tuition fee. The third in this series is why McGill does not offer longer leaves of absence for continuing education. Again, there's that graduate level piece. So this is a training and equity issue, and it's not really talked about on the surface very much.
Well, great themes. There are two, I think, different directions within those questions, and one is maybe the really, secret or quiet expressed, and that is, you know, are there people who stand in your way of you developing and having access to the opportunities that are there? And I must say, we talk about that not only in terms of development opportunities, but even in the way vacations are taken and so forth, where we really want to make sure that people get what their entitlements are. And we're often very bad at that because we can all figure we're indispensable and we can all be told we're indispensable. But that wasn't a question raised, but I must say it preoccupies me as much that everybody needs holiday and you know, you've got to be able to take it and you need to be supported to take it. Similarly, we all need refreshers. We all need opportunities to restore and renew in our work environment, and we need to find creative ways of doing that. So I really want to kind of flag that, Michael and Lynn, for something that we come back to think about what are the obstacles within the managerial hierarchy that may partly, you know, I like to believe everybody's well-intentioned, but sometimes we saw this over the last 3 months, that the instinct was everybody thought about their own unit and how they were going to manage in their own unit. But the only way we could succeed over this fall was by pulling up above the individual unit and saying, how do we accommodate the needs of people across more than one unit, and especially thinking about small units and how do we support those in small units. And so there's something there, I think, about, you know, that I'd like to think it's the rare manager who would want to block someone from having that opportunity, but there may be many managers of small units who think, I just simply can't function without it. So how do we aggregate up to allow more flexibility for people to move around and have exposure to these opportunities? But the other one is, we're really underfunded. So when you think about the things that corporations do, for example, funding people to go take expensive executive management programs, we don't have the financial base to allow a lot of flexibility. We do the tuition, and I'm thrilled at how many people, how many of our colleagues have their children come here, some of whom are the first in their families to ever go to university, and I love that. You know, I think that's a great sign of success. It's the kind of community we can and should be building. But how we create access to programs that are expensive and have real costs assigned with them, and where someone has to be hired to substitute when someone's on a leave,
that's quite a that's a big cost item, and we need to think about a way of bringing equity and fairness into that, but also not just saying we simply can't afford to do it, which is being not creative about finding solutions. I don't know.
No, this is an issue that has been very important to me. I had similar responsibility for human resources at a previous institution, and the philosophy that I took is if the university should be prepared to invest in you if you are prepared to invest in yourself as well, because there are sacrifices that one makes when they take on additional degrees, extra studies and all. So this is certainly something that I'd like to work with Lynn over time and with Heather and the rest of the team, because I think it really is a way to ensure the advancement of the university development, and it's a way to recognize the value that you bring to it. So this is certainly a key issue for me in the coming year.
Just one other thought I have. So it's so helpful to have these, because you also get us out of the box of how we might think and what we might think is on your mind as well. But it does occur to me maybe some things we should have. I always say we're a hybrid institution in terms of how we operate. We're not totally decentralized. We're not totally centralized. But maybe there are some special opportunities that ought to be open to a broader competition in terms of who gets to do what, where there's a limited pool of opportunity for a very elite kind of professional development experience.
Thank you for that. That's a really important piece that came up, and thank you for addressing it. The next piece is equally, or maybe more openly discussed in other realms, but equally challenging. This is our theme two, or part of theme one, theme two, and it's compensating and rewarding performance. So we all know about merit. We talk about performance reviews. We go through the process annually. Greg talked about it and how beneficial it is. In some areas, it's not that beneficial to them because the process is not as an open. Maybe there's lacking some clarity and transparency as to how it's put forward. So we have a number of questions related to this topic that I'd like to read to you. Given the time, I had a little activity that we would bring together, but it'll be too much. So we're going to read, have some comments, and then a dialogue on it. First question in this series. How will McGill identify, reward, and promote the true managers who work hard and often aren't appreciated properly due to the lack of coherent and streamlined performance evaluation system? Next question, the writer says, do you feel that merit pay with a fixed envelope within each unit really allows for a fair expression of a manager's contribution to McGill? The next one, why do we not have a fixed cost of living increase across the board so that everyone can benefit, whereas pay increases are not, that would mean pay increases are not subjective and based on limited dollars within the department? So those are the questions.
So could we, David, just have a few minutes maybe of people making suggestions?
Sure. We can have them work in groups and then pull back if you'd like.
Would that be best?
No. Okay.
Okay.
Group work.
In the committee of the whole, as we like to say in this room, just thoughts and guidance.
Anyone?
Don't be shy.
How can we make the performance process better, clearer? How can we bring you how can we answer to some of your challenges? What are the solutions? Do we put up more information on the website?
What would you like to see that you're not seeing?
Over here. Bob Stanley. I was involved in UNASA for 10 years, and this was one of the issues that was constantly bugging people. I think the thing that irritates people the most is the fact that the assignment of merit increases is limited by the budget envelope for a particular sector. And it makes fundamentally inequitable for those people where there's a large number of people in the unit who are very good performers, top performers, and the merit pool is unable to accommodate that and acknowledge that. I think it's important perhaps to rethink the manner in which that merit pool is assigned, and perhaps more on a sectorial level with respect to the vice principal or with respect to the university as a whole, and then the money is divided up afterwards. rather than having a pre-established envelope just for a particular sector, particular unit.
Did you catch that? Okay. Okay, it was a little bit choppy, Bob. Sorry, I think the microphone is having some issues. Can I turn it over to...
Can we hear one or two?
Yes, please. Okay, so the idea of the current system as it is... I have... okay. Judy.
I was going to mention that in many areas we know that performance dialogue is not being done as it is intended to be completed between supervisor and manager. In fact, it would be interesting to know what the statistics are as to how, or not even necessarily the statistics, but rather the manner in which performance dialogue is carried out. I think that many managers in academic units that report to chairs, performance dialogue is probably just a very brief exercise. You know, how are you doing? I'm doing fine. And then it's determined what that manager is going to get based on that. So it's not being done as I believe that it was intended to be done. As well, I see it being exercised very subjectively, in many cases. And we know that sometimes it has to do with the relationship between the supervisor and the manager as to how it is distributed. And basically, performance dialogue is supposed to be pay for performance, but if your performance is really not being gauged, then we know it's really not being exercised fairly. And I don't want to speak for other managers here today, but when talking to managers one-on-one, many have expressed that. So you may see in one unit where someone could get 10% and another one gets 1%, but yet they're both viewed as strong managers. And how does one determine that one manager should receive such a higher salary increase compared to another?
If I could just add one point
sure,
on that,
sure.
Would be merit being used. It was another question that came in. Merit being used to bring salary levels up to a midpoint. So if that could be added.
Okay, well, let me take a couple of stabs at this, and then Lynn, if you're prepared, because I think there's a question about kind of the standards that are used across the board and how we work to get those in place. Let me just try and pick a couple of the pieces of the original questions. One, on cost of living. And if I understood the question right, one of our problems is we are not given a uniform cost of living increase in the operating grant that we get from Quebec City. And in fact, as we heard at Senate yesterday, where Michael presented the finance situation and Tony presented the budget, that we actually go into the year without knowing what we're going to be getting as a cost of living increase, and it's been the last several years lower than what they told it would be. We were told it would be even when they told us what it was going to be, and it was always lower than CPI technically, so that makes it very hard to standardize it. The issue of how performance dialogue is done and the uniformity of the way it's done is a really important issue, and there's nothing that will substitute for us just doing it. This is just going place by place by place, I think, and I'm looking to Lynn to say where you are on where you are on that. Bob, your question's a really good one, and I've been at two institutions that have had to learn the hard way, this being the second, that if you're going to do these merit pools, you've got to have a level of aggregation that's fair, and you've got to put people around the table who are going to be held accountable at the senior management level, who are going to be held accountable by each other. So so I'll tell you, in our building, in my team, everybody, you know, in the first instance will argue for their own envelope, but the way we've ended up doing it is everybody gets
a notional envelope, they work on ranking the people who report to them. But then we get together as a group and go through everybody. And it's a great chance for pointing out where there seems to be kind of a disconnect between a performance and what's being recognized. But it's also taking out of it the punishment for a high-performing unit. So I think that was your point, that if you have a unit where everyone is, merit ends up being the opposite of what it should be, right? The same is true if you have a low-performing unit. If you have an envelope, you're going to divide it up. Everybody gets, you know, roughly the same if they're all, you know, of the same quality. That's not fair in having a merit exercise if the group next to them is treated totally differently because they're in a different part or for a unit. I mean, that small unit allocation is for units where there's a great range in performance. And when we're aiming for high performance across the board, we need to have better tests on that and better aggregation up. So those are just some thoughts off the top. Clearly some blend of across the board that is meaningful, and merit allocation is consistent with the culture of McGill and our mission at McGill. And we really want to make sure that works well with the employee groups where that's the framework that we have. But I'm going to turn over to Lynn now for some comments on the particulars.
I'd like to talk about performance dialogue. Not to say how old I am, but I've been working 35 years in HR. And in 35 years, I've never been in any company, institutions, organization that have liked their performance dialogue system. Okay, so we'll start with that. People call it performance management, people call it all things. At McGill, we chose to call it performance dialogue. We also chose, and this is before my time, and if you feel that this should change, please let us know. We decided at McGill that it was going to be non-mandatory. I've been in places where you have to do performance dialogue, and if you don't do performance dialogue with your employees, you don't get your increase. I've been in places where we do performance dialogue. If it is not done, you don't get your increase. But this is not what we chose to do here at McGill. We chose to make it on a volunteer basis. We chose to have it done as a dialogue, not as a performance management, and we're very specific at calling it performance dialogue, and in exchange to at least once a year, the supervisor would sit with his employee and have a conversation. So that was the basis of the introduction of the performance dialogue six or seven years ago. It is not perfect. None of them is perfect. But what is important is the dialogue. So seeing that it is not mandatory, it is not centralized. We develop the forms in HR Central and send them out and do the training and meet with the managers and so on, but it is not a centralized function. So we have no copies of anybody's performance dialogue forms in Central or in individual files that we're scanning and putting in Extender and so on. Performance dialogue, when I first started here five years ago, was a very cumbersome process. Now it's two pages. And the focus of performance dialogue, as opposed to us thinking that it is directly linked to performance pay or merit pay, it isn't. The objective is talk about what you've done in the past, what do you want to do in the future, and what development that you need in terms of your career to meet those future aspirations that you have. That's the focus on our performance dialogue at McGill. If that's not what, as managers, you think is correct, right, rewarding, that you have suggestions to do, because it's very, very easy for us to ditch our performance dialogue process. Please send your suggestions to us, because we keep evolving it. It's been changing for 5 years that I've been here to meet the demands of those who have the managerial courage to call us and say, why don't we try this, because it'll work better. Now, let's talk about the unfairness. I always say that there's no such thing as bad employers anymore. But there are some supervisors that need more help than others. So it is with big effort that, and very limited resources, that central HR goes around and tries to, on the faculty units and administrators, where we are asked to do management training for supervisors as well as for employees, to exchange and get into that dialogue. We offer all kinds of sessions at certain periods of time. Yes, a lot of them have been postponed. They are going to restart. I urge you, come. If your supervisor is not the greatest in performing performance dialogue, we can help them along by helping you and coaching you and mentoring you on how to have that exchange with your supervisor. Those are my comments.
Thank you very much. Can I just ask for a show of hands of how many people would like mandatory performance dialogue with more standardization across the university and how it's done? Just a show of hands. Okay. I have to do the reverse now, sorry, because that's the only way I really get the numbers kind of. Okay, who would not? So more would than wouldn't by far. Worth taking back.
Hi. My experience with performance dialogue has always been very good.
Do you want to just say your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. Helen Fife. But I grew up in HR, so that's why my experience with performance dialogue has always been good. But my question is, why has this not been rolled out to MUNACA employees?
I'm going to just not totally duck that one, but a little bit. But a little bit by saying we hear it, so we'll make note of it and come back. We're going to do a debrief on the meeting afterwards. But there's no question that union versus non-union employee groups have different terms of reference with respect to evaluation and other things. So that's the generic response. But of course, management is possible within every employee group, and performance development is possible within every employee group, and that is our goal.
Hi, my name is Romina, and I have not grew up with HR. And I always have one question when it came to performance dialogue. I said it's a dialogue. So why not, it's not the part where you actually evaluate your supervisor and you actually learn from what's wrong or what's missing or what's lacking? I think that could be also a cornerstone for training and basis like that.
How many would like to see that system in place? Where you get to give feedback on your supervisor at the same time. Okay. I don't need to ask for the other show of hands on this one. Okay, thank you.
I have a question here, and then at the back. One second, please.
Sorry, I just wanted to add that, in fact, that I'll be introducing, at least in my own area at first as a pilot, 360-degree feedback exercises. I think it's good to have the evaluation. I think it's also a good development tool. I think it's important for people to get the feedback in a way that protects the anonymity of the participants. But that's certainly something that we'll be working on.
Maybe I can just add too, because what I do with my team is we have at least an annual time set aside for this. This is telling Michael what's about to come, actually, because he's just passed his first year anniversary, and the fall delayed this, but in January. So I send out a notice to each of my direct reports. We designate a time with some good time set aside for it. I ask them to do a self-evaluation against their own goals for the year, and things that we may have talked about in the prior year for someone who's a multi-year employee. Then I ask them to raise the issues they'd like to discuss, and then I ask them for feedback on our own relationship, is how I put it. What's working, what's not, what could be better, and do they have any feedback for me on my own management style? And I'll tell you, I learn something new every year. I hope I try and put it into practice. That's a good part of what's the...
<I'm
time for, excuse me, I have time for two more questions in this series. We're moving really well, but we're coming towards the end of our allotted time. So I have Victor at the back, and I think I had Pierre, no? Okay, Victor.
Victor Chisholm, Faculty of Science. The question about cost of living earlier was framed in the context of our budgetary difficulties. And that seems to me a difficult answer to that question. The McGill miracle is that we do so much, and that has to be how we approach it. Despite our financial constraints, it looks like the grass is greener on the other side of the fence when you're clerical or support or management looking at academics. So why isn't that we can't make a commitment to treat our employees with the basic respect of cost of living, given that you've chosen to hire us all?
Thank you. I think this question has already been addressed. And it is definitely one thing that we'll hear more about. Thank you, Victor. Very challenging question. Shall we move on? Okay, thank you.
Ashraf Ismail. Actually, my question was asked by Romina, but I just wanted to if we are going to have that upward expression of needs and aspirations, I hope it's not going to be in a taboo way or any stressed-down approach, because that would defeat the purpose.
Could you just say precisely what you wouldn't want to see? Just because I understand the emotion of it, but I just like if you could just be more specific for us.
It's always difficult for someone to go against their supervisor, positive or negative. So that's my aspiration is if you're going to implement something like that, is to take that in consideration. So there will be no repercussions for someone speaking their mind in a respectable way.
Right, and it's a critically important point, and it won't work without that. And it's probably toughest where, you know, there are few people reporting into someone, and you may be the only voice of a particular perspective. One of the things, you know, I think we have to do more of in that regard is actually have group orientation and socialization and sensitization to these issues and what the norms are, so that managers don't take personally feedback that they need in order to, you know, we really need to create a culture where that feedback's welcome. And sometimes we, you know, when you hear it, but you need to know, you know, it's given in good spirit and it's going to help you be a better manager by getting it. And I think doing that sometimes in team socialization helps.
Thank you. Now, our schedule is running tight. You have blocks in front of you. This, I would like to just gravitate as we finish up the session towards the next topic. It encompasses where we are right now. It's called rebuilding community. And we've talked about succession planning. We've talked about the issues with performance dialogue. And one of the, in this theme, you had a lot of questions. You had a lot of comments we're not going to get to today. So what I'd like you to do for us, and we'll collect them afterwards and compile them, is take a minute and write what is the one tangible thing that you think that will help McGill to build this community. And I'll give you an example that came out in our M Forum meeting, if I can, Fran. The example is McGill Medicine. The management team in medicine meets with the management team in science. They do it twice a year, once a semester. They talk about the wins. They talk about the losses. They talk about the difficulties. They talk about the processes. So that's one example. I could envision arts and engineering, or, you know, medicine and athletics. Yeah. What's your what's your one tangible thing that you think that could help build the McGill community? And then I'll go to the next step. Yeah. So if you don't have a piece of paper, there is a block right beside you. You have to ask somebody for it. Yeah. That's a fading moment. Okay, in fairness to this activity, it seems like we're some of us are leaving. Are you? I would like to move on. This activity didn't seem to work. We're at a short time frame, so I'd like to wrap it up in the way that I would like to... Sorry, Judy?
I'm so sorry. I had a question, actually, because I sit on UNASA. I'm part of the executive of UNASA. One of the questions I wanted to raise, which I feel is really important because many of our members have asked this, and I know it's been answered in the HR FAQs, but still I feel like this is the forum that I need to ask this question. During the strike, we know, and Principal Monroe Bloom, you expressed sincere gratitude for the hard work that managers did during the strike. And overtime was pre-authorized and will be compensated for and so forth. But we know that the difference between the 33.75 hours and the 40 hours, which totals 6.25, are not at all being compensated for. Perhaps, from my own personal opinion, I could understand taking into consideration the Norme de Travail guidelines and so forth. But in unusual circumstances, and that was just my own personal opinion that I just expressed there. I don't necessarily think it's the opinion of most managers. I think that most managers are concerned over the fact that they are not compensated for the difference between the 33.75 and 40 hours of overtime that they work. Most have expressed to me that they believe that they should at least be compensated at straight time for those 6.25 hours. And I think that under these unusual circumstances due to the strike, those hours were not worked occasionally. They were actually worked week after week after week. And many have said to me that they think that this needs to be looked at because they're questioning it.
May I answer that? We meaning the royal we, the senior administration, and with the discussions with HR, came to the conclusion that because certain units would deal differently with employees, it is a policy. We do not want to change policy at this time. That the 4 days compensation extra either before, after, or at your leisure and your supervisor's discretion and yours be taken before the 31st of May would be compensation for those that policy gap that you so often remind me of. That was the decision.
Did you want to respond on that?
I don't think that that's necessarily addressing this 6.25 hours that managers have worked regularly over the 3 months. I understand that the university is giving a gift of 4 vacation days, but at the same time, those hours of overtime that were worked were done long before the university thought of giving this gift of 4 days.
Okay. Thank you, Judy and Lynn, and thank you all for your wonderful comments, your participation. This is not the end of it. We will post on the web our video, but I would like to finally, let me just take this opportunity, Principal Monroe Bloom, to recognize your leadership in coordinating this meeting. This does reflect your willingness to engage with our community and to make McGill a better place to work, and we're always delighted to connect with you, and we look forward to future opportunities. I turn to you now for closing remarks.
Thank you very much, David. And in my case, the royal we on the preparation is Susan Aberman, who really worked so hard, and you, David, and the steering committee. And so I want to really thank all of you for this.
I used to come annually to meet with the group, and somehow in the last couple of years that had fallen off, and I don't know if I wasn't invited or I was invited and couldn't come. I don't know which it was, but it's really helpful for us. We can't always, as you know, we can't always just say, oh, great idea, we're going to do it. There won't always be every moment of agreement, but I can promise you we will always be smarter in doing what we do if we have this kind of exchange, we being those who are here to support you in doing your jobs, if we have this kind of exchange. So thank you for your openness and willingness to get together. I know Michael and Lynn are willing to meet with you separate from me, but please don't hesitate to invite me as well from time to time. Let me just finish on the question of holiday remind you again how important it is. One of the things that I love about McGill, without question, it's the people and our mission. You know, they inspire me and energize me every day. But we also have quite a good time together, and I would say the last 3 months have just been a little bit less good time than it usually is. It just hasn't been as much fun. It hasn't been as light. And I hope you'll take the time over the holidays to restore and for us to be able to come back and really re-engage in that kind of spring in our step enthusiasm that we generally bring to our life together at McGill. Thank you again for everything that you do.
As you exit the room, there are large blocks of paper. Please take one. Thank you for coming.